The thing is now 306 pages. It took me 3 weeks to write. It doesn't make sense. I mean, the wonderful thing was there wasn't even any sense of strain. It just sort of flowed out of me. And I think it's going to be a bestseller. I'm sure that most of you have it now. And I hope that you're all enjoying it. I know you're all enjoying it. Because it's a thoroughly enjoyable book. It's amazing how many stories there are about Master that nobody knew before. I just remembered one yesterday, and I added it to the book. Master and Dr. Lewis were standing on a street corner in Boston, and Master was in his orange robe. And this man came by on a bicycle. He looked at Master and made a grimace at him. And he reached a big mud puddle. In the middle of the mud puddle, suddenly the wheel came off. He went sprawling in the water. And Master didn't say anything, but there was this impish smile. Doctor was convulsed with mirth. But stories like that, I'm the only one who could tell them, and I'm so glad that I've been able to. It's absolutely thrilling to contemplate his life and to think of all that he accomplished. But I think the most thrilling thing of all is that last chapter on his legacy, what he brought to the world. It's really an amazing thing when you think about it. Many things he couldn't start himself. It wasn't time. He wanted to start a school here. You know what happened in Ranchi? I remember Dubé saying to me, if we get the government to help fund this thing, we can grow four times as fast. The trouble is that if the government gives you one penny, they own you. And they couldn't teach yoga anymore. They couldn't teach any of Master's teachings anymore. It's still true today. They're not able to teach what Master tried to get started. And they just have to teach the usual public curriculum. Well, what's the point in having a school then? And so in this country, Master wanted to start one. You know, his first desire at Mount Washington was to have a school there. But of course, you know, that wouldn't be feasible, possible, or even desirable. Because first of all, you have to have the adults. But the thing is, he wanted people to think in those directions. Naturally, you have to convert the parents before they'll send their children. So he never got that off the ground. We've been able to. He wanted to start communities. He spoke about it with fervor. I remember the garden party at Beverly Hills. This day marks. And my words are sown in the ether, and my truth shall not die. And he talked like that. It was just incredible. I have never heard such a powerful lecture. And I said to Diamata in 1958, when are we going to start doing this? Frankly, I'm not interested. So anyway, it didn't die. We've taken it on. And we have proved that it is possible. We were down in Encinitas, and there was a group of about 200 of us on our 20th anniversary. And one of the nuns there, Sister Shanti, was saying to a group of us, including me, oh, yes, many people have tried to start communities, but nobody succeeded. Well, 20th anniversary is not nothing. But now we're on our 43rd year. And we've proved that it is a needed thing. You know, I think we're going to see a complete shift in the direction of civilization. You know, right now we're at this point where Dwapara Yuga has made a strong impact, but the old Kali Yuga consciousness is still there trying to say, come on, let's have fixed ideas, let's have fixed dogmas, let's have systems, let's have logic behind everything we do, and so on. All old Kali Yuga thinking. nothing fluid about it. Well, now we've found that that tension has reached a point where I think it's going to be a very bad time, and just for the little bit that we have ahead of us now. I remember Master many times in church, he talked about a coming depression, which he said would be much worse than the other. He said the dollar won't be worth the paper it's printed on. That's happened already in the last century in several countries, including Germany, where one man brought his paycheck in a wheelbarrow to a shop, and he went in the shop. He said, no one's going to want this money, so he left it there. He came out, he found the wheelbarrow stolen, and the money strewn all over the street. Well, that is likely to that will happen again. And I remember one time in Hollywood Church where Master stopped what he was saying, and he said, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. And those are strong words. A cataclysm means something more than just man-made. It could be a comet from outer space hitting this planet. I don't know. I know that the polar shift seems more and more likely. The pole, magnetic pole, is changing about 400 miles a year, I think. Could become much faster. Or 40 miles could become 400. Anyway, big changes are coming. And Master said that those who are seeking God will be protected. You know, there was a very interesting thing came out of Japan. You know, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where they dropped the atom bombs. There were two groups there. One was Jesuit, the other was Franciscan, but they were devotees of God. And they were only blocks away from the epicenter of that bomb. They were untouched. Now, that kind of miracle is something that is very notable. When Master said those who love God will be protected, you can be sure of it. It doesn't mean you won't all die. Some people will die. It's not a big deal to die. But it will be true that you will be in some way protected. And this thing in Hiroshima and Nagasaki suggests that the protection will be physical also. But the greatest protection that is possible is having places like this where whole groups of people are dedicated to the divine search. Master talked so strongly about this. I believe, now supposing somebody wants to drop an atom bomb over the west coast of America, will he choose Mount Shasta or will he choose Los Angeles? I think, of course, Mount Shasta, right? But just on the mild possibility that it might be Los Angeles, it'll be devastating. I think that cities will no longer be the wave of the future. I think mankind is going to stop having cities. I think when maybe all the dust is settled, we'll find that people are automatically going to start gravitating toward these small communities. Master said this ideal would spread like wildfire, and I can see it happening. The need for it. You know, nowadays, people with computers, it used to be that you needed land to be wealthy. Now you can become wealthy from your basement. It's not a problem. And this will mean that society will become less and less centralized. I think that America, I hope to God it's true, that America will become less centralized. I know one time Master was complaining briefly about City Hall. They were demanding that we put in sprinkler system in rooms that just didn't need it. And he said, sort of the way everybody says jokingly, oh, there ought to be a revolution. Then he paused a moment. He said, there will be one. It's inevitable when people don't have anything and they find the government's been lying to them and the government is not helping them, they're going to rebel. I think that we're heading toward a smaller government. Anyway, I do think that in the immediate future, things will be difficult. But I think in the long range, it's going. I can see a society where it's mostly green and people living in small villages. And we can help set the tone for places where people live for God. This, I think, is a very important legacy that we have preserved and that will go on. In my books, I have never written a book without trying to make it seminal rather than exhaustive. You know how the German philosophers will try to say the last possible word so nobody can add a single thought beyond that. Well, I've done just the opposite. I've tried to make seed thoughts that people will then take and turn into new books and new books and new books. And this whole idea, these ideas will spread so that everybody can be helped by them. And I think that all the different subjects I've covered, all the different subjects Master covered, they will have a great impact. Master's first book, you know what happened was he went to Japan to sort of get a taste of modern civilization. Then on the way back from Japan, he had an idea and he wrote down a few thoughts, but he wasn't into English. He didn't know how to write English then, whereas his disciple Dhirananda did. So he gave the job of editing that book, sort of writing it as a ghostwriter, to Dhirananda. And Master never liked the book. It was very pompous. But the basic teaching was something that I think when people get the impact of this teaching, it will change their lives. He says, first of all, man only wants two things. One is to avoid pain, and the other is to find happiness. I had a wonderful experience many years ago. I was in Florence, Italy, Firenze, as they call it. And we'd had a meeting with our distributors there. And in the hotel room that night, in this dream, I saw thousands of people. And I realized that every single one of them was my brother or sister, because everybody wanted the same thing. We've all come from bliss, and that's our basic motivation for everything that we ever do. We may seek it wrongly. A mafioso may think that I'll get it through money, through power, through revenge. But everybody is seeking bliss, and the whole reason for our long, long journey through many incarnations is that we are seeking that bliss. And when we understand that that bliss lies inside ourselves, not outside, we'll have attained what we want. And so I woke up from that and I wanted to write it down. There was no paper in the room. Usually they leave you note paper. I had no paper in my bag. I finally found a little doily under a glass. And I wrote on that in tiny letters as much as I could. But basically this reason, what I wrote there, has had a great impact on the rest of my life. Because of this simple fact that everybody in the world is seeking the same thing, bliss. Everybody is my brother and sister. And I really feel it. Wherever I go, I feel that these people are my own. And the more you have that thought and this reason for loving everybody, the more your whole life becomes a very sweet thing indeed. Because you see that there's no reason for being defensive. There's no reason for feeling offended. Just, you don't have to worry about other people and what they will give to you. Just give to them. The answer to the question, how can I be loved by everybody, is love them. Don't worry about their reaction. The reason I've never been nervous in public and lecturing, which thank God I haven't been, had been basically that I think in terms of what I can give to them, not in terms of what I want from them or whether they will like what I have to say. It just doesn't matter to me. If I can give to them my best, then if I'm a fool and a complete jerk for what I say, well, let it be. But this is my little offering. It may be nothing, but it's my offering, and what more can I give? So let me not worry about it. Well, this attitude, when we give to others, this is the reason for our new renunciate order. We want to get rid of the ego. We want to understand that God is the doer. God is acting through us. And everything that we do is only to the extent that we can express His power. Now, how could I write a book of over 300 pages in 3 weeks and make it deep, not shallow? I didn't do it. That's a simple answer. I just knew what I had to say. It was given to me. I didn't do it. If I had to do it myself, I'd be puzzling over the first sentence still. But you don't have to think that way. In inventing things like what you do, in writing, in cooking, in anything that you do. I remember Master, he prepared a dinner for us, and he was cooking in the kitchen. He came out of there so blissful. And I think he had a great experience in the kitchen, but he said, I was just putting my mind here, and I could taste the food here. I didn't have to sample it with a spoon. And that's how, if we do everything from here. You know, when I began meditating, I used to think, now, how do I put my mind here? Do I look up from below? Do I look from above? Because after all, my brain's above. Do I look from here? Do I look from there? I just didn't know. But then finally I understood. The ego, Master said, is centered in the medulla oblongata. It's here that the sperm and ovum meet to create the physical body. And from there they go into the brain, they go down the spine, they go out into the nervous system and create the body. But this is the seat of ego. And so you can see people who are very proud, they look down their noses, as it said. But it has nothing to do with their noses. It has to do with the tension they're feeling back here. Now, the whole job of the spiritual life, in a very real sense, is you look from here. When you're looking at the spiritual eye, think of yourself as centered here in the medulla, and then look at that and try to bring your energy forward to that point. And when you can feel yourself centered here, you're a master. It's really just about that simple. A master, people do everything with reference to this center. You have to do it from here. And the more I can feel it from here, the more everything becomes blissful. So some of these things are so simple, and yet they take lifetimes to learn. Because we're so stupid. Anyway, Master brought us a fantastic thing in this simple truth that everybody in the world is seeking happiness. And the reason they do so is that we're all expressions of His bliss. And you know, another wonderful thing was in Shankaracharya's definition of God as Satchidananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious bliss. Master added to that, ever-new. That's not inherent in the words. But what he was saying is that bliss is ever new. In every individual, it's expressed differently. It's not some boring thing, oh yeah, bliss again. No. Everybody is a unique expression of that bliss. You know, that's why every saint is different. Everybody, every generation, they think, oh, why isn't he like that saint? Why isn't he like this saint? And they sort of get judgmental about Master or anybody. But in fact, the wonderful thing is that every saint expresses God and that bliss in a unique way. And you, when you get rid of all this outer sheath of ego and self-definition, you will discover that you are a unique expression of that. Unique in all the universe. That is an incredible concept, that for every moment of eternity and every point of space, that bliss is ever new. It's a fantastic thought. But you don't have to compare yourself with anybody else. Everybody has his own unique song to sing through all eternity, and it'll never get boring. It will always be new. So this is a great teaching. It gives us the reason for being, for living a moral life. It gives us a reason for helping other people. When people think they want to put money first, you know, what is the delusion of money? I've mentioned that in this book. The delusion of money is that you don't have a specific thing you get, but you see this great hall with all these lights shining, and each one of them is vaguer than the next, and none of them says anything specific, but this seems to promise video, fame, a beautiful wife or husband, all the things that people want. They're vague enough so that you think in terms of, well, if I get enough money, I'll be able to get it all. And so money becomes an obsession. And at the end of it, what have you got? Ulcers. a heart failure. That's a great deal. Why don't people understand that if they're going to work, they should at least work for happiness? And you don't work for happiness, you work with happiness. And so this simple teaching, if it can be spread out into society, has the power to change society. So we have education, we have communities, we have this basic, you know, I took that basic thing in The Science of Religion, and it was written extremely pompously. Dear Ananda was a pompous ass. And forgive me, Master used to say, a pompous dash. But I rewrote it as God is for everyone. So it made the point. Master didn't like the book, but he liked the basic teaching. His whole teaching was based on that. So these are a few of the things. But beyond that, in every walk of life, we see that what he brought, I believe, is going to have a major impact. I hope this book that I've just written will be a bestseller. You know the cover I've thought of for it? You'll never believe me. You'll never. You know that story of that picture of Master with the tiger? That's the one I want. I think it's fun and it's charming and his face is beautiful. It's full of light and power and humor. And it's really, I think it'll be a great cover. Anyway, we'll see. I'll probably get thousands of letters protesting. But anyway, oh, but, is it dignified? One of the lovely things about Master is that his dignity was natural. He didn't put it on. Anyway, I do feel that Master's legacy, you all have to help with this, because it never comes just through one man. But if we can help to spread these ideas, it will be, it'll change the world. The world in the future will be a golden, beautiful place. Master said there won't be another war for 300 years after this period. No. People will be so sick of fighting. But anyway, I'm so happy that I finished it, that I was able to have a satsang with you all. And just before all the big invasion comes from our different communities, I look forward to it all. Now, let me ask you if you have any questions, and I'll do my poor best to answer if I can.
Can we use the microphone? If anybody has questions, we'll just pass them on.
Oh, yeah, I need a translator. I'm practically deaf as a post, so...
This is because it's being broadcast throughout the internet also.
Hi.
Hi. How do you deal with fatigue? How do you conquer fatigue?
Conquer fatigue or deal with fatigue?
I thought when I was about 25, about when I was 82, now I'm more than 82. And I'm giving a lecture and saying, and the one thing, at least. These teachings give you is strength. Well, in fact, Master used to say that the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. And if you can just get a little enthusiasm, you'll find that fatigue doesn't really bother you. I get some fatigue sometimes, of course, mainly because I just never seem to sleep more than 2 hours a night, and makes me kind of desperate. But I make up for it. I don't know, with all this making up for it in the day, I still wrote this book in 3 weeks. I don't know. Anyway, don't forget that it depends on your willpower. If you have the will, if you can become enthusiastic, you'll find that you have the strength. Okay? Any other questions? Hi, Ray.
Hi. Well, I've been contemplating the free will concept, and all of a sudden it popped into my head. It was this afternoon that when the Jews were trying to escape from Egypt, that the Lord kept on saying that he would harden the hearts of the Egyptians.
And it, what?
That
he was kind
of, I heard the Egypt thing.
Okay, the Lord said he would harden the hearts of Egyptians.
So that they wouldn't respond to these tests and it would come. And I was just wondering about that. Sometimes,
you know, it is hard to understand because God does, when things are to happen, he makes them happen. In this case, it required that their hearts be hardened so the Israelites would separate themselves from Egypt. And, you know, when I first got the Brigu readings, I was very concerned about this question of free will. Because if somebody who lived 5,000 years ago knew that I would be born in Romania and my father would name me James, which is my first name, that I had brothers but no sister, although one sister would die in my mother's womb, this was all true. How could somebody living that long ago know? And does that mean we have no free will? I realize that, no, we don't have that kind of free will. God is omniscient. We have the free will to turn toward him or away from him. That's all we have. Otherwise, it could be known long, long ago, what color tie you would wear this morning. Everything that you do, it's already known. God is omniscient. But you can decide that today I will love God more. That he leaves up to you. So that is the degree of free will. Nonetheless, that degree determines whether you move toward happiness or toward suffering. And you can change, you can drag that process out for countless incarnations. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita and also in the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, it speaks about people coming into delusion, into Maya, at the beginning of a day of Brahma, still wandering in delusion at the end of that day of Brahma. That's billions of years. I mean, are we likely to be? You begin to wonder how many days of Brahma have been wandering. It's a scary thing. I say forget about being scared. Just do something about it. No. You can get out of it when you want to. Okay, let's see what other questions there are.
Hello.
of advice for the newer devotees?
For who?
For new devotees.
Advice for newer devotees.
Love God. It's really very simple. Mind you, you're no new devotee. This may be the first time around this time, but you've been a devotee before. And there's nothing new in the world. Just love God. Everything will come out. But I think this much is true. You know, when you start a motorcycle, you have to put more energy out in the beginning, because otherwise the world can pull you back. So in the beginning especially, put out as much energy as you can, and then you'll have the strength to carry on. Then comes the middle ground, where it's difficult. But if you get that energy going at first, you'll go through that. Okay?
What would be the greatest piece of advice you could give to those who are trying to start community in today's world?
What would be the greatest piece of advice you could give to those who are trying to start communities in today's world?
You know, when I started Ananda, it was very difficult to do. Everybody who came had his own ideas of what they thought communities ought to be like. And I had to exercise a lot of patience. And, well, I don't want to go through all that. It was not easy. But now that we've got a pattern established, it's very easy to say to anybody who comes, look, this is how we do it. If you want to do it differently, go and do it on your own. So the best thing would be to come here, learn how we do it, and then with whatever fine-tuning you want to do to make it your kind of community, that's fine. But it would be much easier if you can start a community saying that I'm a part of a movement, and these are what we have found work. And so I ask you to do this, or else don't bother, because we can't go every way. I know that many ways are good. This is our way. It'll help very much, that. Another thing that will help a lot is something I found from the beginning, that if I give the energy to those who are in tune and ignore those who are not, the naysayers fall away. The solid core becomes stronger. And there was a time when the whole community confronted me, saying they wanted certain things their way. And I said, look, I'm tired of all this one horsepower energy. I said, I don't ask things of you very often. But I do say this, I'm the founder of this community, and I want you, if I ask you to do something, I want it to be that. I don't want to have to fight about it. If you don't like it, I can leave here and never look back. And I'm not a fool. I did this when I knew I had a majority on my side. But we lost about 50 people in that little adventure, but it cleared the air. I think new communities, we've got new communities. We have them in Portland, Sacramento, Seattle, Palo Alto, Assisi, Gurgaon, Pune. Everywhere it's working beautifully because we simply have something that's already going. So if you want to start a new community, I would say the best thing would be to come here to Ananda, learn what we do, and then affiliate with it. You don't have to do the same thing. Honestly, I don't see a million Ananda communities in the world. That would be a headache. But if we could have many people inspired by what we've done, they'd find it much easier to go to a new place and say, look, we're a part of a movement. And that movement could include Hare Krishnas, it could include Christian fundamentalists, I don't care who. But if they would follow a certain system, just like our renunciate order, it's for all paths. So our communities, beyond the confines of what we've done so far, will have to be open to lots of different ways. And I don't think we should place any strings on it. just help people to start these communities themselves. I don't think everybody wants to join a community, has to come here. What will we do with them all? But if we can inspire them, and they can say, we're already a part of something, and this is how we do it, it'll free them from endless burdens and headaches. So do that. Okay?
Just to make this a little more comfortable for people in the back to ask questions, we'll have another mic that Patricia has, which is a cordless mic, and we'll pass it down the row and back from the center aisle.
Okay. Any people in the back?
Good evening, Swamiji. Can you speak about how we know if we have a divine friendship with someone?
How do we know if we have a divine friendship with someone?
If your energy is more toward giving than toward receiving. Think in terms of what you can do for this other person and what you can give. Then it becomes a divine friendship, where there's mutual giving, not mutual taking. And of course you receive, but the energy when it's giving is a pure kind of friendship. What more can I say? I don't know, but we have such wonderful friendships here. And they work just because of that principle, I think. Okay? Do you think I'm right?
Why, yes.
Okay. There's one over here.
Hi, Swamiji. I just was wondering if you could speak about how important it is for those of us that don't live here, I live close to here, but to get to group meditations versus meditating alone, and if it's just personal or if there's a, if you could just say something about
that. In group meditation, there's a group, you know, this is something, in my last class in Los Angeles, I emphasized magnetism. Magnetism is one of the most important things in life. When you get a group of people doing the same thing, you have much more magnetism than when you're doing it on your own. When you have a group meditation, there is a power that comes that helps each person to meditate more deeply. And this is what you notice here at Ananda. The moment you come onto the ground, you feel that there is something here. It's that group magnetism. Magnetism can be used in so many different ways. You know, you all know the story of my passing that Greek exam in college. I convinced myself I was a Greek. With that thought that I was a Greek, I had the magnetism to attract that knowledge. I found that I can learn languages that way. When I went to Bali, I was up on Mount Gunung Agung, which is 7,000 feet high, and well, even on the equator it can get cold. And I asked this man for a blanket. Well, unfortunately, the word in Balinese for blanket, the word blanket in English, sounds like a glass of water in their language. And so he brought me a glass of water. It was the last thing I needed. And I thought, I've just got to learn this language. I was there only 2 weeks, but by the end I had a vocabulary of 600 words, and I was able to talk about philosophy and all kinds of things. How? By having the magnetism to just somehow let it flow. Magnetism creates that flow. And so in business, if you have the magnetism of business, you will find the ideas coming to you, the opportunities coming to you. Very few people realize how important magnetism is in their life. Some people go into a thing and suddenly everything flowers for them. Other people, no matter how they work, nothing works. So if you develop magnetism, you can learn languages, you can be success in business, you can attract inventions, you can attract ideas for a book, you can attract friends. How is it that people become friends? You know, when you love somebody and that person dies, you don't lose them. Your love will become a magnet. You'll be drawn together again and again. And they can live on the other side of the world and you'll be drawn together. How did I, born in Romania, master born in India, master coming to Los Angeles, somehow we met? Magnetism. And that magnetism comes, you know, when you have electricity going through a wire, the stronger the flow of electricity, the stronger the magnetic field generated. And so with you also, the more energy you put out, the greater will be your magnetism. And through that magnetism, there is virtually nothing you can't accomplish. A very important word. Okay, any other questions?
What's your next book?
What?
What's your next book?
Look, before I began this one, I thought I'd written them all. I don't have any expectation, but I just think, well, God knows.
Hello, Swamiji. I was wondering if you would share with us your favorite Shakespeare quote.
My which?
Favorite Shakespeare quote.
This above all to thine own self be true. And it shall follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. That was the advice that Polonius gave. And it's very, very true. Okay. Or I could say enter pursued by a bear. Any other questions?
Can you speak about how we can deepen our love for God?
How we can what?
Deepen our love for God.
There are a million ways, of course. But the most thing is to overcome all of the, what Yogananda, what Sri Yukteswar called, the meannesses of the heart, the ego. The more you think about yourself, the less you can think about God. The more you love yourself, the less you can love God. The path of life, in a sense, is very narrow, and there's no room for both of you to walk that path. Either you, your ego, or God. The more you think of God and forget about yourself, the more He gives you that. You don't have to develop that love. Ramakrishna talked about a pundit who gave the advice that he said, God is dead. You have to sweeten Him with the nectar of your love. He said, that's absolute bilge, garbage, nonsense. He is love. You don't develop your love and give it to Him. It's with His love that you can love Him. The more open you are to Him, the more you find your heart becoming flooded with that love. So it isn't that you have to somehow develop a particular personal skill. He gives it to you. The more you get yourself out of the way and offer yourself up to Him. Okay?
Good evening, Swamiji. This is a hard question, but I have trouble with perceiving God with pronouns like he and she. Can you talk about that?
He's neither. And he's...
Okay.
But he's also both. In the West, because Jesus talked of God as the Father, we have this tradition of calling God he. But I, in my heart, although I say he, I think she, that God is my divine mother. I think, too, in this age, that feminine energy is going to become very important. And in a way, Kali Yuga of one-pointed, one-sidedness, masculine, is very Kali Yuga. We have to understand that feeling is the essence of consciousness itself. You can't reason your way to understanding. You have to feel it. Man represents feeling, reason. Woman represents feeling. Feeling unbridled becomes emotion. Feeling, if it's calm, becomes intuition. But really, without the feminine aspect of humanity even, man would be very one-sided. And of the two, I have to say I think the feminine is the more important because the most basic. Here at Ananda we have, I think I can say it with complete truthfulness, absolutely no discrimination. To us, both sexes are absolutely important and they balance each other out. But I have to say that if I'm loving God, it's easier to love the mother than the father. The mother is closer. She forgives me, like this black man who came to a judge in a court and that said, how do you plead? He said, Your Honor, I pleads for mercy. And women are more merciful by nature than men are, because men go too much by reasoning. I think many of the troubles in the world come from that rational bias. I think the Catholic Church is a good example of what I'm saying, and I'm not going to say more. Okay. Okay, any other questions?
Sir, what do you think of the new Ananda Portland community land that
I'm
just bought?
I'm absolutely thrilled. Really, I'm very happy with that community. I have great hopes of the future. It's certainly going to be a... Huh?
I can hear cheering in the Portland group.
Yeah. But I'm absolutely thrilled with it. It's just what we have needed, and it can become a model for all our communities. So, I mean, there we've got all those buildings already up. I'm all for it. Yeah. I was all for it in the beginning, but when I heard 4 million, oh my God. But now it's down to a figure I think we can handle. And, I get money sometimes. I hope to get pots of money with these movies. I don't want any of it for myself, but if I can channel it into projects like that, I certainly will, because I'm keen to see those things happen. This is it's going to give our education system, that can become the center of our education system. Much, much good can come from it. So, yes, I have nothing but good to say. Yes.
Hi, Swamiji.
Hi.
I was wondering if there's any more that you can say regarding the movies in Los Angeles and what.
Well, let's
you...
see. There are three movies that we're talking about now.
Yes.
One is a movie about Yogananda. This will be a standard movie. They'll have to raise at least 10, 12 million. It's a process where they have to get a lot of actors and everything. They were wanting me down there. I'm rather thinking and hoping that they won't, because I'd like to go to Italy and help launch the Education for Life there, and go to India and launch this new book there, and a few things. And what were we talking about?
The movies.
Oh, yes, movies. Well, it's a little embarrassing, but they're having two movies about me. And one nice thing about it is that usually when you make a docudrama like this, it's about somebody who's already dead. And in my case, I can talk about it and say, no, it wasn't like that, stupid. It was. And so anyway, they've become exposed to Ananda, and they think, my God, this is a story in itself. So they want to do a movie about my life and touching on Ananda. Then they want to do a movie about Ananda itself. And I think I'm all for it. This idea has to be brought into the world, and I'm thrilled by it. So anyway, that's where we are as far as I know. Shivani is coming maybe tomorrow. Anyway, this weekend, you can talk to her, and she'll give you some idea. She's working on the docudrama. And they want to go to Italy and to India and show all our communities, and many things are coming of it. And I have great hopes. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Swamiji. Can you speak about developing calmness within one's activities?
Calmness?
Yeah.
Within one's activities.
You know, Krishna gave a very good answer to that question. He said, Nishkam karma, act without desire for the fruits. And that way you can act calmly, do what you have. Like when I wrote this book, it really was a book that years ago would have caused a great deal of stress for me. There was no stress at all. It just sort of flowed. The same thing with the time tunnel, which is coming out, I think, very soon. But I wrote that in 2 weeks. And I started to read The Wizard of Oz. You may think, what would I read The Wizard of Oz for? Well, I myself can't answer that question. It seems like a singularly stupid thing to do, but anyway, I did. And I got only as far as the Yellow Brick Road, which is just the beginning of it. And suddenly this idea came to write a children's story. And I had never thought of writing a children's story before, but I sat down without any effort at all. It just flowed out of me as if everything was handed to me on a silver platter. And all the ideas came, but the idea of ancient Egypt, for example, the idea of ancient Atlantis and so on, I don't know if it's true, but it makes a lot of sense. And it was a great romp. And beyond that, there's a great deal of truths that I could express very simply because it was a book for children, children of all ages, including my own, but nonetheless, children at heart. And I'm very enthusiastic about that book. It has a great deal of potential, and it's great fun, and the protagonists are all nice people. They're not just bratty little children getting angry at each other and snipping at each other and so on, that you always find writers putting in for realism. I just forgot all that stuff. And really, I think somehow God has given me sort of an ability to let it flow without difficulty. But one reason is so is that I don't have any thought for the future. I'm just doing it for the fun of it. And it comes out perfectly. So one thing is, don't have a desire for the fruits of your action. Act, but let him act through you. And third, do it for joy. And when you work with joy, joy will express itself through you. That's all I can give you. Except meditate, of course, every day, and then... Any other? Well, auction one. Okay, thank you all. God bless you. It's really been a joy to be with you. Thank you.